Well, if you don't already know it by heart, by the end of tonight, I think you'll have a Bible verse memorized. So the manliest verse in the entire Bible is what we're going to look at. What's your name?
Stay away from my drink. Is that yours?
That's mine. That one's mine. Stay away from my drink. Get your own drink. So at the end of Corinthians, Paul has been pretty hard on the Corinthians throughout the whole book. A lot of times we forget to read books of the Bible as letters or letters of the Bible as letters. And so you read with the wrong tone. I'm one of those who thinks that our book, 1 Corinthians, our letter that we have, 1 Corinthians, is actually probably at least two, if not three, letters packed into one. I tend to agree with that theory, but this is why you get a tone change at some point. But here at the end, it's kind of funny. I was hearing a friend of mine who preached on this passage not long ago saying that the end of the book of Corinthians feels like, the scribe. So Paul didn't write with his own hand. Typically, he said what he wanted said, and then he had someone who was writing it down in the form of a letter. Is that the scribe? It's like the scribe said, "You know what? I've only got like five more minutes, Paul." Or was, "Listen, we've only got half a page left. What do you want to do with it?" And that's how we get the end of 1 Corinthians. Is very much so this like staccato machine gun, attack on bam, 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 bam. These different issues that are just thrown out as quickly as possible. They feel even a little like a non sequitur, and this one very much so does. And so Paul is like making sure he's answering certain questions that has been asked of him or whatever. So one of the questions he asks is about a guy named Apollos, who you read about in the New Testament. Apollos, who some people apparently considered a competition for Paul, that he was apparently such a good teacher and did a good job when Paul is referencing people choosing a man to follow, he references himself, Cephas, meaning Peter, the Apostle Peter, and Apollos. And so we don't have a letter from Apollos. Apollos was not one of the 12 unless the name was changed or something. But Apollos is an important dude. And so here you have, again, it reminds you that when you read it like this, it reminds you this is a letter. It wasn't written to you. It wasn't written to me as a letter form. We get to read it as the truth that the Spirit inspired to have in there. But so when you read verse 12, concerning your brother Apollos, I strongly urged him to visit you with the other brothers, but it was not at all his will to come. Now, I don't know if he's throwing Apollos under the bus here. Like, I don't know how, like, this is pretty harsh. Like, listen, I tried to tell him he should come, and he just isn't interested. So, sorry. I mean, it's kind of a weird, it was not his will to come. He will come when he has the opportunity. Again, this is a letter that may have taken months to get to the Corinthians. What an odd thing. But, and then that's verse 12. Verse 13 and 14 are two of the most powerful, simple, gut punch verses in the Bible when it comes to what does it mean to live life. And I'm going to teach them out of order so that you can see why we call this kind of the manliest passage. It's the phrase that's in the middle, if you've got a Bible with you. 1 Corinthians 16:13 has four phrases in it. The first one, your Bible's like mine, the ESV, may translate "be watchful." Not a great translation if you're looking for literal translation. The literal translation here is "watch." And the audience listening to it would have gotten that. Watch, stand firm in the faith, and then you get this fascinating word that ESV translates literally correctly, act like men. Andrizo, andros meaning man, and the rest of that word being a reference to behavior. Act like men. This word doesn't appear anywhere else in the New Testament, anywhere else in the Greek Bible. And so this is the one time it's used. When it is used, it can mean any number of different things. Culturally speaking, a lot of what we consider masculine traits is also what the Greeks and the Jews and the Romans considered masculine traits. Toughness and courage and that kind of stuff. Not that women aren't supposed to be these things, but culturally they're kind of masculine. And so a lot of your translations, if you have an NIV or maybe even a New King James, I think it says "be brave" if you've got a different translation. But the word there, andrizo, to interpret it correctly, means act like men. I don't know that means this passage isn't for women. It's just saying, hey, I've just got a second here to close some stuff out for you. I want you to know this. It's almost like this is a note. Because the next little verse 15, is going to talk about brother Stephanos and household of Stephanos. And so it's again back to a person. Like, this little phrase, is it have to do with Apollos coming? Is like, so be this way in case Apollos shows up. Make sure this is the truth of you or what? Is this a note that Paul's like, oh, I meant to tell you this too? Or the brothers who are with Apollos this? Or we don't really know. It feels like a non sequitur. But he throws out there these words. But act like men. The word there, andrizo, like I said. What's funny is I heard a speaker reference one time that this means to complain, to be afraid to admit your shortcomings, don't ask for directions, be afraid to look foolish, like sit around while the women work. You know, that's what it means to act like men, right? And so I think that was a female speaker, though, so I don't, you know what Paul says about that. But the idea of this is a, like, this idea that Paul is setting a standard in some way, we need to, his audience, he wants his audience to act like men. We looked at the video last week, or the little mini videos of the guys doing the jumping out of the tree. I still think that is a powerful one. Like that imagery of act like men, meaning challenge each other, call each other out. If you're a member of the church, here's the kind of stuff we need from you. As we struggle through, and we're really wrestling through this, I'll tell you, we're really wrestling through this as a staff right now. I told you that one of my goals, that one of our hearts and thoughts in regards to this with the church, is that we have a stronger and stronger shepherding mindset. That this is my church. That everyone would say that. This is my church. And so if there's a mess, I clean it up. If there's something that's broken, I try to fix it. If there's a, like, it's not like, oh, I need to call in the professional to clean up the trash that's on the ground. Like, that's ridiculous. We need to take care of this type of stuff. Why wouldn't we do some of those things? And we want to get away from that model of, you know, you come into a classroom and it's messy, that you, you know, call somebody and say, hey, this classroom is messy. Like, it's your church. Clean it up. It's not that hard. Just straighten it up. That being said, so here's part of where the conversation comes in. And it's sad to me that this has to be a conversation. I'm not putting this on anybody. It's on me too. It's sad this has to be a conversation. At the same time, there's something psychological in us that we say, well, I did that, so now I shouldn't have to help with this. We do it in our homes. You know, it's our natural tendency when our wife or brings something to us, like, hey, it really would help me if you would do the dishes. I'm like, dishes? I just did the laundry. Because obviously if you do dishes, you shouldn't have to do laundry. Like, that's, isn't that the way the world works? Is, but I did some one thing. I shouldn't have to do something else also. Like, there's a psychological aspect. There's no doubt there's a reality. We're a limited resource people. We have limited time. We have limited money. We have limited energy. I was telling Bobby right before this. I remember learning in college, like, my biorhythm from 6 to 7 is when I'm at my tiredest. Like, right now, I could be asleep in 15 seconds. Flat. Easy. This is like my tiredest time of the day. We all are limited creatures. We only do so much. And so part of the conversation I'm having in my mind, and that the staff's going away on a retreat in a few weeks, that we need to be having, is what do we prioritize as a church? So what are the most important priorities for us, ministry-wise and service-wise? And I think doing a good job, that's important, doing a good job of training up a next generation is probably the most important act of worship that God has given us. So I'm going to talk about this next week, some at the ministry huddle. Sometimes I think the most important trait of what it means to act like a man, and again, there's not a biblical place to go for this. So what does God mean when he says act like a man? We've talked about that before. I don't know if you remember that, but that I don't see any evidence of biblical masculinity. Nowhere in the Bible do I see what God expects from men as compared to what he expects from women versus the roles he gives. Like, there's not character traits that's good for a man to be courageous, bad for a woman to be courageous. It's good for a man to be honest, but bad for a woman to be honest. It's good for a man to be gentle, but bad for a woman to be gentle. I don't see any of that. And so what you're stuck with is this idea that biblical masculinity means taking on the roles that God has given us. Father, son, brother, husband, etc. So do we act like men? I think the one place where you do see it, aside from the Philistines, just tell each other to act like men, and I don't know that we want to use them as theology training, but is when God tells Job to gird up his loins, which only men did. The only time God speaks in a term like that, when he says, gird up your loins, and that's when he's essentially about to get a return lecture from God. So that is very much so it's my turn to talk now, and you're going to take it like a man. Is kind of the language there in the Hebrew. But otherwise, we don't have a lot. So here's what I think. I think the idea of the servant leader that God calls men to be in an extraordinary way means, part of what act like men does is it means you don't quit when others quit. That's got to be at least part of it. You keep, and I'm going to show you the other three. Let's look at the other three. Again, if you got your Bible, the first one, watch. Military term. Has anybody, I know we have some military guys here. Any military who's ever, anybody, who do we have? Anybody, who's military? Do we have anybody here tonight? Just one or two? You ever had to stand watch? What does that mean?
Stay awake.
Okay, stay awake. Yeah, that's important. When everyone else is sleeping, right? Why are they sleeping? Why is it okay for them to be sleeping? Because you're on watch. That's what this means. Watch here is the military concept. You watch. What's the presumption while others sleep? You watch. You want, the military word is here. You stand watch. You take care of it. A lot of you know the imagery I use, and I talked about this last time, the imagery I use for men's ministry is the phalanx, the formation of interlocking shields. But one of the mindsets in reading about the phalanx and where they come from is that some of them said the idea was the image that they were trained to have was that their shield that they were wearing was not just protecting them, but everything behind that shield. So this shield is what protects me from the enemy. It's what protects the man behind me from the enemy and the man behind him from the enemy and my wife back at home from the enemy and my children back at home and your wives and children back at home. And that's why their rule was you come back with your shield or on it. To lose your shield, for the Spartans to lose your shield in combat could be punishable by execution. To come home without your shield could get you executed. For dereliction of duty. That's the idea. That shield is so important. That's watch. My first ministry passage ever when I was 19 and a student minister, and I taught one Wednesday night with a bunch of teenagers and just nothing. I mean, nothing. Nothing was penetrating. Now, I'm sure that's partially my fault. I didn't know what I was doing, but I mean, nothing. I was sitting and talking to them and just glazed looks. Most of you are married men. You have an excuse for having a glazed look. But they had no excuse. These were teenagers. They had no excuse to be just like nothing. And I was like, this is a huge freaking waste of time. What am I doing? I'm thinking about doing this for the rest of my life. That's just ridiculous. And there are definitely times you feel that way, for sure, I'll tell you, in this job. But in the end, Ezekiel 33 is a passage that rescued me from that. I know what Ezekiel 33 is. Ever seen it? It's the parable of the watchman. God speaks to Ezekiel directly, and because Ezekiel's having the same problem, no one's listening to him. He's warning them that God's judgment is coming, and no one's paying any attention. See, God told Isaiah that was going to happen. He warned Isaiah about that. Ezekiel didn't have such a clear warning. He told Isaiah, hey, your job description is you're going to go warn the people that I'm going to destroy them all, but they're not going to listen. So ready? Go. I mean, like, talk about a defeated job description. Ezekiel 33 describes a situation where there's an enemy approaching. The watchman has two responses. The watchman can warn the people or fail to warn the people that the enemy is coming. If he warns the people either listen or they don't, that's not his problem. If they listen, great, they can rescue themselves. If they fail to listen and they're all slaughtered, that's their problem in Ezekiel 33. The language is their blood is on their own hands. But if the watchman fails to say anything and the enemy comes and slaughters all of those people's blood is on his hands. That's a pretty intense passage when it comes to living this out. This is the key passage for men's ministry everywhere. When you go to any men's ministry everywhere, they're going to probably have this verse as a part of it. Rightfully so. This is for us. Watch. Anybody familiar with them? Can you look up for me 1 Chronicles 12:32? 1 Chronicles 12:32. Y'all familiar with the sons of Issachar? Look how it describes them. Men who had an understanding of the times. These guys get a lot of press for someone we know no one about. We know nothing about them, except they're described this way. Men who had an understanding of the times. They were watchful. They knew what was going on. They had their eyes open, their ears and eyes open. So in a military situation, which is one of the most common examples Paul uses throughout Scripture for the Christian life, our eyes and ears are open for what? We have two things that we're listening for and watching for. Okay, absolutely. You're thinking big. You're thinking more specific and more accurate. Stick with the analogy. If you're a soldier, why are your eyes and ears open? There's two things you're listening for. Okay, one is bad guys, enemy, right? What's the other one? Orders. That's the other one, right? That's the other thing that is very applicable. Watch. So here's how I see it and why I want men's ministry to be the lead and integrated concept is that when we think about raising up a new generation, vacation Bible school, children's ministry, youth ministry, mission activities that involve the young people, that kind of stuff, our job is to be on watch. If we're not there, we're not watching. Like, that's a part of what we're there for. We're watching to see which of the kid needs special attention. Sometimes those boys, they need one of us to engage with them. You've seen it. You've experienced it. You were one of those boys. I was one of those boys who could, it got to a stage where I could dismiss the input of women pretty easily. But the minute a man spoke, all of a sudden they had my attention. There's something about that. You may have even seen, if you watch, like we engage with each other's kids all the time, so rightly so. But I mean, going out there today and a bunch of boys out there throwing dirt in where they've dug out an area over there. And so as I'm walking up, you can tell which ones are, I mean, they're all dumb kids, so they're all doing dumb things, but you can tell which ones are well raised because they're the ones who, when they see me coming, start putting their hands in their pocket and like, they at least know they're doing wrong and they know they're in trouble when they see me coming. But walk up, hey guys, gather around. So we may know what this is. No, we don't know what that is. Like, let me just clarify. Let me make it straight, boys. You have no idea what this is, so you were throwing dirt on it. Like, does that make any sense to any of you guys? Is there a step I'm missing, boys? Like, I don't know what this is, so I threw dirt on it. And they were like, no, that's not very smart. I was like, it's not very smart, which is weird because I know you guys. You guys are pretty smart guys. And then there's this big orange fence thing. What do you think the bright orange fence is meant to indicate? Uh-oh, stay away. I think so. I haven't asked either, but I'm guessing that the bright orange fence means stay away. Guys, let's have some wisdom. You know better. Stay away. Yes, sir. Yes, you know. They need to hear that sometimes from another man. They need a guy to step up and say, I'm demanding something more from you. Not just I'm chewing you out or whatever, just, but hey, I'm demanding something more from you. I know you, and this isn't wise, and you know better, so cut it out. There's something about that. Our kids need that. So that's why they need. By the way, I was going to tell you, John Redfern Sr. over there, Here's what's wild about you guys who are over 65. This is what's wild. So we knew this was coming. I used to go, I don't know if Jason ever heard me do this, but I used to actually speak at camping conferences about the millennial generation and the generation coming up after them. Did you ever go when I spoke? And so one of the things that's weird about this generation that of young people, they're the ones who are right now our teenagers up into their mid-20s. A millennial crossover, it's a kind of a millennial crossover. Millennials are supposed to end at a certain point, but this trait isn't ending, and I think I know why. So with media the way it is, which ones of our heroes, sports heroes, movie stars, religious heroes, which ones of them can we trust to not let us down? Yeah. Yeah, it's like it doesn't make any difference, right? It doesn't matter if you're Bill Cosby. I mean, you can be Clifford Huxtable. What was his first name? Is that right? I mean, you can be the dad of the century, and it turns out you're doping women and having sex with them. I mean, this generation of young people know with social media, they know they're not safe. Them putting their faith in anyone is just waiting to be disappointed. That's not going to change because of that's not the cohort. I don't think is going to change. I think that's moving forward. That's young people. They are watching. It happened with us too. We just didn't know about it. I mean, how would you have known, if you're my age or older, how would you have known if a pastor in Dallas fell? Or a pastor, much less a pastor in Maine or New York or what? You wouldn't have. Now it's all over Facebook. It's all over social media every time that happens with somebody. So they know and they watch just fall. They know that it's only a matter of time till families get divorced. Happy marriage now just means a divorced family later. They see it everywhere constantly. And so here's what's wild. This was predicted about them that they would be this way, and it is dead on. So the last 2 weeks with John Redfern Sr. preaching, and the week before that, the guy, Dr. Rowling, teaching through the Bible stuff, my sixth grader and my 11th grader came home and were like, "Dad, that was awesome. That was so awesome." They give an automatic pass to people with gray hair, this generation does. Because they figure if you're, what'd you say? Did you say you're 70? How long have you been married? 46 years. They figure at some point you're probably a safe bet. Like they can assume if you've been married 46 years, you're probably going to make it to the finish line. Now we all know that's not necessarily true, but the odds are much better. And that's huge for young people. They need to see consistency lived out across time. They need to see those of us who aren't older or aren't that old, they need to see us when we are that old, that they've now watched us for 30 years and we're still consistent. It's amazing to me how many young people in this generation don't know that anything lasts forever. Some of you know, if you're a child from divorce, you have very little intuition for the thought that anything lasts forever. Separation and things falling apart just intuitively feels imminent. And so our kids are watching it all around them. That's powerful. We need, so you go, I don't know if I can do VBS. I don't know if I can do children's ministry. I don't know if I can do youth ministry. Well, figure it out. Find a way to get invested and get involved in such a way that people can see it. And where kids can see it, where young people can see it, they need that. They need to see that. If it's, you just say, "Listen, fill me in when you need me." Rebecca told me this week. Remember we were going for 270? Was it 270? Wasn't that the number we were aiming for? And we had 203. We were like 67 away. That's when we told Rebecca we wouldn't go to two services until we got 270 volunteers. So at 203 volunteers, we went to two services, which means we lied. So she told me that today that she's 80 volunteers behind on the year right now. So the problem is we keep growing, but our volunteer base isn't growing at the same rate. And as men watch, we have to be there to watch. And this isn't just you. You're here. I know a lot of you know this, and you're trying to do it. You can't, or maybe you can't do it for some reason or another. You're not a member yet for some reason. That's fine. Or you're a single guy, and it's hard for her to fit single guys in. That's fine. I don't hear this as guilt. Hear this as we have an opportunity to live out what God's calling us to do with this next generation. Watch. And then, again, as if this doesn't need reminding, stand firm. Ephesians 6 talks about the armor of God. What's the reason? Why do we wear the armor of God? What does it say? So that we can stand. In the end, to stand. That is a great goal, that in the end, when it comes, whatever it is, we're still standing. Again, military language. That's, how do you know? What's that from? Oh, that's from Untouchables. Untouchables, anybody? Yep. Yeah, old Robert De Niro. How do you know you got a prize fight? How do you know who won the prize fight? At the end of the fight, it's what? Y'all remember? The guy's still standing. That's right. It's the guy still standing. That's who won the prize fight. That's a great line. I ought to pull up that scene. Anyway, who knows what language is in it? You got to be careful. Yeah, that's it. Again, this is military language. Stand firm in the faith. When the battle is over, you still be standing. There's going to be corpses everywhere. You still be standing. That is a, I thought you were about to pull up that clip. I was like, oh, okay, just a Bible verse. We're good. I reference movies that I cannot necessarily recommend. So standing firm is a big part of the goal. Stand firm in the demands. So stubborn is when we stand firm in what we want. That's inflexible. That's not what's being talked about here. Not standing firm in yourself, not standing firm in your opinions, not standing firm in what you think is best or right. Standing firm in the faith is the key here. Not pushed around. Not washed back and forth. Not to the left or the right, but we're still standing. That to me is cool. This is very much so military combat language all the way through. Watch. Stand firm in the faith. Don't be pushed. Again, remember, this is the Romans fought just like the Greeks did. Two armies that would clash into each other, shield on shield, and then they would push. There's like a 2-minute segment of the movie 300. I don't recommend any of that movie except the 2 minutes when they actually show what the phalanx looks like, which you can just YouTube that shows two armies coming, smashing into contact with each other, shields, and then they just start shoving back and forth on each other. And what the Spartans and the Greeks did better than anybody else was push. And they could push back against massive levels of strength and energy and push back against them. Each person would put their shield in the small of the back of the man in front of them. And they would, in rhythm, they would push like that and shove. The Greeks, only the first few rows, their spears pointed out. The rest of them held it with the spear point pointed down, because what they were going to do was they were going to push over the men backwards like this. And then they would just march over the top of them, stabbing down as they went over the top of them. As you're getting this pressure to fall, stand firm in the faith. This is largely discipline. It's interesting to me. There's been a couple of people over the last few years who've kind of famously, I'm rolling my eyes, but who've kind of famously said, like, I'm not going to go to church for a year. I'm not going to read my Bible for a year. I'm not going to pray. I'm not going to do that. And see if God is real enough to hold me in place after a year. And I'm like, yeah, what about the Bible would tell you that you're not going to have a psychological disconnect during that time? It has no bearing on whether God is real or not. You're a frail creature. You're not standing firm. You're sitting down. Yeah, that's not how this is going to work out. Standing firm in the faith, doing the disciplines. And we have so many opportunities now, unlike anything in the future, anything in the past. It's unreal. You want to hear a sermon taught on any passage in the Bible? You want to read 15 commentaries on any passage in the Bible? It's all at a click. It's unreal. How I don't know how we did any of this before. I mean, I don't know how I made it through seminary without all this stuff. I must have had to literally go to the library and look up these things. I don't even remember doing it. Like, it was such a mind-numbing experience to be digging through these ancient books that no one had... I mean, they hadn't been checked out in decades, Southwestern, maybe centuries. It was unreal how just no one ever looked at this, and I'd found it somewhere and was looking for it, and really just to copy a quote from it, which I had to hand cut. I couldn't even cut and paste. I had to like hand write it. It's the idea that I can now just type in John 3:22 commentaries and go to Bible Hub and have 15 different commentaries offered to me on godly men. It boggles the mind. There's no excuse for us not stand in the faith. It is available everywhere. There are daily podcasts and forums. A Denison forum is every day, right? Weekday or weekends too? Every weekday. So that's one. Al Mohler is one I listen to a lot of times. And I don't disagree with, I don't agree with anything. I don't agree with everything I say when I look back on it. So I don't agree with, but that doesn't matter. There's so much material out there, man. There's no excuse for us not having this. The gospel is a gift and we are saturated with it. Anyway.
We got to be like General Grant, who never let horses go backwards.
There you go.
But he had more to sacrifice than
Southern. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the whole, yeah, he could lose battle after battle after battle and win the war, which is, I mean, inevitably we win. We know this, so we shouldn't be afraid of each battle when we know the war is a decided factor already. We know who's going to win the war, so to battle and battle and battle, win or lose is not, I mean, we're going to be doing it anyway.
The best general,
no. That's right. Even though they called him blood and guts. Watch. Stand firm in the faith. We talked about act like men. Is there anything else I want to comment on that? Take responsibility. Be shepherds. Dare to risk. Those are all the things under act like men. Those are the positive things. Challenging one another. Daring to take the risk. Trying things which men aren't necessarily known for. Taking responsibility. And then be strong. Man, what a great word here. So the character trait of strength. Strength is the ability to create or resist movement. That's what it means to be strong. To be able to create or resist movement. That's what we're supposed to be doing. It comes up regularly in the church sometimes, but it's a, I mean, we talked about it, but the idea that the gates of hell not standing against the church means that the gates of hell are on the defense. If gates are resisting, they're on the defense. They're on the verge of defeat. And I think it's natural for us not to think that way. So why am I talking about this verse tonight? And by the way, and then you have this last one, which is the motivation. Why? Naturally, you would ask why. Why watch? It's not fun to be on watch. When I've yet led young men's discipleship groups, a lot of times we do campouts and stuff like that, and I always have men, they have to go on watch. They have to be on watch for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, depending on how many of them there are. They have to be on watch, and then they have to wake up the next person and get them up and wake up the next person and get them up. And it's a great teachable moment, whether it works or not. Like on the next morning, you find one guy sitting out there by the campfire like this, and he was on watch from the 12 to 1 shift, and everyone else slept in. You get to teach about watching and failing to watch and what that means and why. Why watch? There's no fun to watch. It's funner to not have to watch. Standing firm is tiring. It's exhausting. I don't want to stand firm. I want to quit. I want to stop. Act like men. It's easier to act like boys. And be strong. Create and resist movement. Prepare yourself to create or resist movement. Why? Why would I do this? And the answer is verse 14, let everything you do be done in love. This is the agapeo love, the charity love. It has nothing to do with the recipient. They get no vote. If you love your wife, agapeo love, she has no vote in it. She doesn't have to like it or want it. Doesn't matter. She gets no vote. To agapeo somebody is to seek God's best for them, to sacrifice to see God's best in their life. That's what we're called to do. But we're called to agapeo our enemies, to love our enemies with this love. We love even our enemies. We're supposed to do everything we do. Watch, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong in love. Living those things out in love. That's the goal. Yes, it may be in discipline, but the reason we discipline is because the root of love. It's something that we're willing to do. It's easier for us to long-term to engage in because we choose to love, to keep seeking out God's best for others. And so in our church, I want our church, the role of the men in our church, to be defined by these four things. That they look around and they see that we are watching. Not judging, watching. That we're on guard. And that doesn't just mean against an armed intruder. We all love to fantasize about that. I mean against false doctrine, which is that one's pretty easy too, to be perfectly honest, for the most part. How about against divisive talk? How about against gaps in the wall? How about against, oh, there's a need over here, I better step in? And we don't want to burn anybody out, obviously. But there's a whole church of us. I mean, if we're all striving for this, it doesn't seem like it kind of ends up being like putting up chairs or something. Like, yeah, five of us do it, then we burn five people out. But if 20 or 30 people do it, no one gets burned out. And God has set it up that way. Or if we allow somebody else to do it, then they'll do it and they will get burned out. But if we all step in, it doesn't happen that way. That's what would be a motivator. The motivator is love. So watch, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. Ready? All right. We'll say it. Watch. Good. Do it again. And then the last one, let everything you do be done in love. That doesn't add too much to it, does it? Cool. Take it off the screen. They're cheating. No, that one too. Take that one off too. There you go. You can read about Stephanus all you want. Okay, you ready? First, watch. Stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be strong.
Let all that you do be done in love.
Excellent. This is the definer for us. This is what it means for us. So I hope that we will, and this many men as a model, as an example, stepping up and doing this. And here's the thing. I know this is what happens during the semesters on Wednesday night is they start big and there are reasons not to come. And I'm not begrudging, belittling, or mocking that. I totally get that. If I wasn't teaching, I might not be here. So I get that. I totally do. That's not what it's all about. We don't measure success based on who's here. But this mindset being fed into the church, being exemplified, being modeled by the ones who are here that we watch. And here's the thing. You know perfectly well, just like I do, if there's a need, if you go to guys and say, you stand up in your life group Sunday morning or something and say, okay, here's the deal. How many of you are volunteering in some role on Sunday morning? And anyone who isn't, you say, well, I am, which requires you to be, I am, and here's what I want to recommend. Now, not everyone can work with children. Like I said, there are reasons why some people can't work with children, but everybody can work in some capacity. There's stuff to be done on Sunday morning, which is our high tide moment. Wednesday night, they're never overwhelmed with help. Always can use more help. With things like Vacation Bible School, we're focusing on kids. Absolutely. Now, we have a very generous church. When we decide to do some things, it's like, yeah, there's more than enough people going. But I don't know. I will tell you, men, I don't know what to do with the fact that my executive director of ministries is 80 people short on the year for children. I don't know what to do with that. I don't know how to solve that. I don't know how to fix that. I don't know a process for that. I'm not willing to set aside the money to hire that many people. Aside from the fact that I honestly would just be embarrassed. I think Rebecca would quit because she would be so embarrassed that we would need to hire that many people. I would feel that way too. What we need, we have enough people. There's not a shortage of adults to do it. It is almost everybody though. I mean, it really is. So some role on Sunday morning, we need a bunch of, we need greeters. Sunday morning is just a good chance to practice. I don't want to ever hear, I don't even know how to say this. Like Sunday morning isn't the end-all of the Christian life, not even a little bit. Like, it's the three minimal hours. The idea is that Sunday morning is when we get to invest together for the same purposes and the same cause for a few hours, practicing in community what we've been doing all week in our individual communities, in our homes, with our wives, with our kids, with our neighbors, with our coworkers, with all that kind of stuff. Like, that's there. Sunday morning is meant to be when we come together and do that in this big, what therapy world calls gestalt, or philosophy world gestalt, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We're able to accomplish more as a whole than just the individuals added together. That's what Sunday morning is meant to be like, I think. And so we have lots and lots of guests, hundreds and hundreds of guests. That must have been Lance.
And I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
3 months in a row. And I didn't mind it. I got glad to deal. You see, but the previous church I had, need more people, but they never asked anybody.
Yeah, I'm asking everybody right now. Like, this is the ask. Yeah, we try that too. We'll do that too. You'll hear too, one by one, but it is a... That's the thing is, it shouldn't be the job of the staff to ask individual men to do something. God is calling us to do it. I shouldn't have to come one to one to ask for each thing when we know there is a need. As men, we should be able to step in. He doesn't hire people to mow the grass. I don't hire people to mow the grass. Not everybody. I don't hire those people. Someone else hires those people who hires those people who hires those people. That's how a big company works. That's how a church works. You're owners of the church, so you're the president of the company. You should be able to work. You shouldn't need me to come hire you. This is the church. I shouldn't need to come hire you. We one-on-one, I'm telling you there's a need. I can't go to 800 people every week and ask them to volunteer. That's not how that works. I'm just... Respectfully, I disagree with you. I think there is a need, and we know there is a need there. It is great when we can ask, but we shouldn't have to pay someone to ask us to serve in the church. You're a servant in the church. You can ask someone to serve in the church one-on-one. Any of you can. Leadership board and staff leaders and life group teachers and whatever. Those are good. I mean, those are all important things too. We need people making the coffee. That's a good thing to be doing on Sunday morning. Part of the hospitality. If you don't know where to fit in or where to serve, you can go to Lance, and Lance will find a place for you. Or someone else will. We can, or go straight to Rebecca or Aaron or whoever. There's a need. Yeah, was there? Yes, sir. Sorry.
One comment, a question really quickly. In regards to children's ministry.
Yes.
I assume that most people in here are serving in some capacity.
Probably.
Donuts waiting for you, like VIP donuts waiting for you when you show up. I'm not super excited about children's ministry, but somebody who wants to come in and serve, you just say, hey, I'm just willing to serve. It's about as easy as it gets.
Yeah.
And we have great leadership and people who are taking care of us and setting that up for success. So if you feel like it's intimidating, it's really not. I mean, it's so simple. And about half the time we get to the lesson, the other half of the time we're just playing and coloring and talking to kids about Jesus and just spending time with them, and hopefully me showing them what a godly man looks like, mm-hmm. and my wife showing them what a godly woman looks like and what a godly relationship looks like. And so it's just an awesome opportunity. We do it once every 3 months. I think we're on a rotation. So we do it for a month every 3 months. So we still go to a class the other 2 months. Nobody's ever said, where have you been for the last month? They all kind of know if we're not there, it's because we're serving. So.
Right. Yes, exactly. It's unbelievable amount of work that goes into making it easy for us to do it. And it's a win. It's a great opportunity. So yes, I think that is a, It is very doable. And it's the victory for the kids is in experiencing us and what it says to them. Over time, they learn and realize, wow, these people, I mean, you may not have known it then, but I look back on, like I said, on Miss Pat,